One thing where I think we've made progress is on the definition of war itself. So war is state-on-state activity, and traditional war, of course, involves armed conflict or physical force. In my view, it's not necessary to use both terms, armed conflict and physical force, because they mean the same thing. So I think it's helpful to define war in with that level of clarity. So war, the other feature of war, of course, is that there's a threshold factor in war. So all hostile state-on-state activity is not war. So espionage, for example, is not war. So which is why the LMA clauses talk about impacted states where there has to be major detrimental impact on an essential service. That is addressing the threshold factor to take it beyond espionage to war. So I think that we have seen a degree of progress.
Do you want to hear about the latest developments in the cyber market and learn best practices and thought leadership from cyber insurance and security experts? We talk all things cyber insurance industry, international growth, cyber claims, and more. Welcome to the Cyber Insurance Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Hess. Stay tuned.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the show, Julian. I'm really excited to have you on. This one is a little different than what we normally do. You know, I thought after talking with you, it could be really exciting for people and interesting to have a war exclusion focused show. So I thought, yeah, you're definitely the person to do it. So let me kick it off by asking you to tell us about your yourself, your team, and your company.
Thank you very much, Anthony. I'm delighted to talk on this topic. I think about it on a daily basis and have done now for 2 or 3 years. And so I'm a partner in the London office of DAC Beechcroft. So we're a large national and international law firm. And a lot of the practice of our firm is supporting the insurance industry. And we provide a broad range of services to the insurance industry. I sit in a team which handles both breach response and cyber coverage issues. My own area of focus is cyber coverage. I think I've sat on something like 7 committees now of the IUA and the LMA, looking at cyber issues, exclusions, silent cyber, cyber war, and so on, aggregation. And so I spend a lot of my time thinking about cyber coverage issues, drafting cyber policies, looking at cyber endorsements, and so on. Cyber is obviously global issue, but inevitably reflecting the large share of the market that US corporations have, and quite a lot of our work is US focused or acting for US insurers in one way or another. But we also do a lot of Lloyd's syndicates generally and a number of participants in the London market.
Okay, interesting. So I guess, unlike, you talk to maybe the more breach oriented folks, their focus is probably they interact a lot more with insureds. Would you say in your case, like, is there a balance? How often are you dealing with insureds, or is it almost all insurers that you work with?
Yes. Well, as a coverage specialist, I do work actually with brokers as well. But I work with brokers and insurers and reinsurers. And as my work is non-contentious, it can be contentious. I can help to resolve coverage disputes. But when I'm drafting cyber policies or cyber endorsements, then I'll act for brokers or insurers or reinsurers. And in some ways, it helps keeps you honest because the brokers are emphasizing the need for insurance and protecting their clients, and the insurers and reinsurers, of course, have a different perspective. They're looking for risks that are within appetite and to make sure that the policies and endorsements are coherent and consistent.
I guess you can answer this question in a few different ways, but I always like to know, what would you say either your company's or your team's strength in cyber specifically is?
Well, I think the joined up approach that we have, where we have a prominent role in both a breach response and cyber coverage and participating in the marketplace and joining committees and having a voice, being on platforms, is we're probably, you know, at the head of the pack in that sense. And we've invested in cyber for the best part of a decade now. The incident response partners saw cyber as a likely growth area when there was no work in cyber at all. But they realized that this tsunami would be approaching rapidly and really committed to this space. And then I was drawn into it to draft cyber policies initially, and then to look at cyber coverage issues more generally.
Yeah, I guess it must be, I almost want to say more than a decade. It just seems like as long as I've been doing cyber in London, you know, which is 11 years now, I feel like DAC has always kind of been around in the market. So cool. All right. Well, I thought it'd be interesting to jump into, you know, some more talking about the war exclusion, but first, maybe we could set the scene a bit, just kind of discuss, you know, some of the history of what, let's start with the history of the war exclusions work in Lloyd's.
Yes. So a few years ago, in the aftermath of NotPetya, so NotPetya is the nearest we've had to a systemic cyber risk so far, isn't it? And so in the aftermath of NotPetya, a number of participants in the market thought, well, we need to revisit the war exclusions, because the war exclusions were silent on cyber risk. And that is because the most prevalent war exclusion, NMA 464, was drafted in 1938. That reflected the concerns for insurers at the time. It was the timing was aligned with the Spanish Civil War and the growing concerns in Europe in the lead up to World War II. Cyber considerations were obviously not relevant at that time, and there hadn't really been any significant advance in thinking about cyber threat and insurance since that time. So the LMA formed the Cyber War Working Group, and that developed the initial iteration of the LMA cyber war and cyber operations exclusions. And a colleague of mine, Hans Ornart, and I were very much involved in supporting the work of that group, and we've remained involved ever since. So
was that like 17, 18? Sorry to interrupt you there. Was that like right after NotPetya, or did it kind of take a while?
No, it took a while. Lloyd's was concerned to get it right, first of all, and they also wanted a range of different options. So it took a couple of years or so before the clauses were finalized, and they were published in November 2021. The chair of that group said the NMA 464 has been around since 1938, so the best part of 80 years, and he predicted that the LMA clauses would not have that degree of longevity, and he was absolutely right, because within a year or so, the further iteration of those clauses has been published. So we then moved on from that to the Merck judgment, the first instance judgment, where the judge held that the absence of any reference in the war exclusion to cyber operations could entitled the insured to have an expectation that cyber incidents were covered. And that drove further the commitment to examining this space and making sure that the market had fully considered the threat of cyber war and state-on-state cyber activity. And so then, of course, the further thing that happened, which really drove this message home, that the need to do something about it and keep it top of the agenda, was the invasion into Ukraine by Russia on the 24th of February 2022. So that was just 3 months after the clauses, the first LMA clauses, had been published. And then they were absolutely center stage at that point, because there were very real fears that Russia would deploy, you know, cyber threats in the campaign against Ukraine. And to a large extent, that hasn't really materialized to anything like the scale that was anticipated at that stage. But of course, that conflict is not over, and there is always potential for further conflicts and further escalation of, you know, cyber threat in state-on-state conflict.
I think it's been interesting, you know, how we haven't seen a lot of it, because I think if there were, you know, a couple parties, you know, going to war, you know, that would lead to, you know, cyber operations. That would definitely be the one I would have thought if you'd asked me 3-4 years ago, because, you know, you mentioned NotPetya, but just the sort of the countries involved. Yet, you know, for most of the last year, it was kind of the opposite. You know, that they were busy doing other things, or, you know, maybe things that we're not aware of from a cyber perspective, but certainly the cyber crime side of things has gone down over the last year, picked back up more recently, obviously, but it's been interesting to see.
Yeah. So the next stage in the development in this issue is Lloyd's issuing its bulletin in August 2022, requiring syndicates to address cyber war as a risk in standalone commercial cyber policies, where they required the clauses to consider a certain number of issues and to be legally reviewed. And then Lloyd's also imposed a deadline of the 31st of March for insurers to have considered this issue. And during that process, the LMA reviewed and published a further iteration of its own clauses in January of this year, on the 18th of January. And then, of course, we've seen a number of carriers produce their own clauses in the run-up to the deadline of the 31st of March. And the LMA has published the clauses, which it's approved on its website. So there's still activity at Lloyd's. We can expect further clauses to appear in the approved list, whether unqualified or qualified. So in some cases, Lloyd's has specified that there needs to be a monitoring of the risk because the clause is not otherwise fully compliant. In cases where attribution is not addressed specifically in the clause, Lloyd's has signaled that it is willing to permit business to be written, but it wants to understand the carrier's ability to assess attribution, and it wants to see that there's an experienced claims team in place, and it has processes for addressing attribution in the event that that's a controversial issue.
Okay, interesting. So I guess, is there anything else in terms of, you know, how we got to where we are today that you think is important to add?
The litigation with Mondelez and Merck formed part of the backdrop. Of course, as we now know, the Mondelez action is concluded without a judgment being handed down. And on the 1st of May, the Merck appeal judgment was handed down. And that affirmed the first instance decision. So that has emphasized the need that the market needs to address cyber risk outside of traditional war exclusions. It needs to be a further clause which considers cyber risk in express terms if this is to be excluded from policy. So that's the most recent development in this particular space.
Yeah, it has been interesting. It does create a lot of, it's always a lot of controversy with when these claims end up in court, and a lot of arguing over what's actually going on there. But it is good in the sense that it's emphasized, you know, you really do need something like this. You do need to take into account war, systemic risk, etc. Cool. Well, I thought it might be good to look at then. Okay, so we've covered the history, and now it's, you know, where are we today? So we're past the Lloyd's requirement. It's in place, as you mentioned. There's a website with different approved clauses. You know, what are maybe some of the common clauses that you see out there, some of the most well-known ones, and some of the key differences between them?
I think we should always start with the LMA clauses themselves when considering that question, because they've been carefully drafted, they've been much scrutinized, and they are, of course, compliant from a Lloyd's perspective, and they will fit together coherently in towers. They will be appropriate where there is back-to-back reinsurance. And a clause which I think it's very important that we don't overlook is LMA 5564A, the first clause in the series, which is the most straightforward. It excludes war and cyber operations. It's the shortest clause. It's the clearest clause. It will be suitable for most SMEs. It will be suitable, although this suite of clauses has been drafted to be used in standalone cyber policies for commercial companies. That clause in particular is suitable for other lines of business, which include some level of cyber cover, or where it's appropriate to exclude in clear terms cyber risk. It will also be suitable for many SMEs. So where the premium doesn't warrant a consideration of a more complex clause. So as we progress through the four clauses, they do become more complex and introduce further concepts. And the LMA 5567A is going to be suitable for many larger corporations because it does have further write backs in it, which will reflect the higher premium point, which will usually apply for those policies. So I think it is important, that they've been carefully drafted, that they're coherent clauses, they're approved, and they will be suitable in a large number of cases. We do then, of course, have a range of other options. Carriers have developed their own clauses, some of which are highly innovative and a very welcome contribution to the market. And the brokers have also contributed to this, not without controversy, it has to be said, but I'm happy to discuss those further as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. If there's any,
obviously the Marsha, as we know, is substantial, a player in the cyber market, and important to take note of their contribution to this subject. They've engaged very fully and provided feedback to the LMA and Lloyd's on their view of the best way to approach this, and that's very valuable participation. That their own clause is admirably succinct. It's quite clearly drafted. It doesn't address attribution, which is one of the things that Lloyd's was seeking. I think attribution has generated perhaps more attention than it warranted, because the clauses which the LMA sought to introduce say little more than the party shall have regard to the evidence that's available. But it became an issue which attracting attention and controversy. So Lloyd's recognized that in publishing its B versions, which omit any reference to attribution, and that's replicated in the Marsh Echo clause. The Willis clause, she does in fact address attribution in succinct terms. Another feature of the Marsh Echo clause is that a write back in respect of NIMS 1.2 and 1.3, that's not without its challenges, because 1.2 is the exclusion for cyber operation carried out as part of war. So a collateral damage write back, which extends to 1.2, could be said to write back an element of war risk. And fundamentally, the purpose of these clauses is to exclude war risk and state-backed cyber activity on another state, which exceeds a certain threshold. So to write back in an element of war risk is not without its challenges. And then a further feature of the Marsh and Willis clauses is that when looking at the exclusion for a cyber operation causing a state to become an impacted state, that there's a write back where there's only one essential services provider affected. Again, that's not without its challenges, because if that services provider holds monopoly, then that may well lead a state to become an impacted state. Mm-hmm. So if, let's say, it's a telecoms provider and there's a single nationalized telecoms provider in a state, then that may well have quite wide ramifications. And then so care would, if this clause is adopted and there is a risk of that phenomenon arising, a certain amount of clarity would be needed to ensure that there isn't a clash with an infrastructure exclusion, for example, to ensure that the cover that's being provided is quite clear and isn't going to lead to coverage disputes where it's not clear which provision overrides.
That's an interesting point. I was thinking about that. So, you are often excluding core infrastructure, for example. So if you're explicitly covering something on the sort of war side, but you're explicitly not covering it on the infrastructure side.
Yes, and although a certain level of coverage disputes is inevitable as a market develops and new responses to new risks. Nobody welcomes coverage disputes. They're costly and time-consuming distraction.
You know, we've talked through some of the common clauses, things people are seeing, the LMA clauses. Are there any other ones that you've seen either approved or not approved, but you know, seem to be going along the right path to getting there, that are kind of novel or interesting or different than the main ones?
Well, it's important to mention, of course, the contribution to this subject by Chubb. Chubb have invested a great deal of time and effort and energy into developing a very different approach to this subject, and that's a very welcome contribution. And the same can be said of these, where they have an admirably succinct clause again. And I think this is innovation is very welcome. I think one thing that the market should be wary of is introducing clauses which are just marginally different. And because if they're used, for example, in the same tower, just in a different access layer, perhaps, and then coverage issues arise, or different clauses are used year on year, and there may be uncertainty as to whether there is a distinction in the cover, and in those circumstances, coverage disputes can arise. So, taking perhaps as an example, in terms of attribution, the clauses in the market now seem to have landed on at the direction of or under the control of a state as being the threshold for addressing attribution. And in the prior generation of clauses, different languages using it as by or on behalf of a state. So if you have some clauses which use one formulation and some other clauses which use the other formulation, or if reinsurers use one formulation and the reinsured uses the other, then issues arise whether or not those protections are back to back. And when significant sums of money are at stake, then that can put that sort of thing in very sharp focus. So I'm keen that innovation is good, proliferation of clauses is not good, and unless there's a material difference which genuinely advances the subject. So I would encourage carriers not to seek to adopt clauses which are not materially different, or where there is a risk that there would be a dispute as to whether or not they're materially different.
Yeah, but that might get into trying to think through various scenarios and how things could go wrong.
I can give another example of that actually, which is in the context of the LMA clauses themselves. Now, having praised the LMA clauses, they're not without their issues. And so, for example, one of the issues is, what about the immediate run up to war? Now, this was flagged up by the Viasat satellite attack, which occurred very shortly before Russia invaded Ukraine. So the LMA gave up very careful consideration, and they introduced into their clauses that the war exclusion should exclude incidents in the immediate preparation for war, as well as war itself. But that does not feature in the first clause. That is an unfortunate distinction, in my view, and it does flag up the question whether there's an intended distinction or whether this is just something which is not a material distinction. And I just use that as an example where there are just slight differences in the clauses, and it's probably not intended to bring about a different outcome, but different language is used. And so if this does appear within a program of covers, then it may lead to inconsistent results if it's scrutinized by a court.
Okay. So I guess we've kind of talked a bit about a couple of them. We're getting into challenges. You know, what are the sort of challenges do you see just around, there's probably a few different categories of challenges. Let me start let me stick with sort of other wording challenges first. Like, what other challenges could arise from the actual policies and how they're worded?
Yes. Well, one thing where I think we've made progress is on the definition of war itself. So war is state on state activity, and traditional war, of course, involves armed conflict or physical force. In my view, it's not necessary to use both terms, armed conflict and physical force, because they mean the same thing. So I think it's helpful to define war in with that level of clarity. So war, the other feature of war, of course, is that there's a threshold factor in war. So all hostile state-on-state activity is not war. So espionage, for example, is not war. So which is why the LMA clauses talk about impacted states where there has to be major detrimental impact on an essential service. That is addressing the threshold factor to take it beyond espionage to war. So I think that we have seen a degree of progress. I'm not an unqualified fan of some of the concepts in the second limb of the war exclusion, where it refers to civil war, rebellion, revolution, insurrection, and so forth. I mentioned earlier that the NMA 464 clause was drafted in the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War. And I think this is a hangover from the replication of the NMA 464 language. And I would like to see that taken out of a war exclusion, and so that the war exclusion focuses on state-on-state hostile activity, which exceeds a certain threshold, and is less concerned with internal civil disturbance, because there are threshold issues in civil disturbance, for example, because when does a riot become a revolution? When does civil disturbance become a civil war, and so on? And I don't think that it's easy to answer those questions. And most people in this debate have been focusing on the first element, so the use of cyber means state on state. But it is fair to point out that these war exclusions are including internal civil disturbance within the war exclusion, and that is not straightforward to apply from a coverage perspective.
Well, I think the threshold statement, you know, you've mentioned it a few times, you know, and then all the arguments around attribution. I think that, at least coming from the cybersecurity perspective, a lot of the noise and a lot of the confusion, you know, we shouldn't do attribution at all, or attribution is kind of, you know, it's not that reliable, so how could we exclude something based on attribution? But I think that you raise the point around thresholds. And I think the threshold is probably, you know, it's the first thing you need to deal with. And then you kind of have the attribution.
Yeah, yes, that's very true. Because if it's not apparent that it's state on state for the first element of the war's definition, and it doesn't exceed the threshold, then you're not in the territory of the exclusion. And so we don't need to be troubled by it. Attribution, we've talked about that, attracting unwarranted noise, in my view. I suspect that in 99.9% of cases, attribution will be something that the parties will be able to reach agreement on, even if there isn't necessarily a government announcement. And then sometimes there will be compelling political reasons why a state will not attribute a cyber attack to another nation state, and then they may not want to further antagonize a counterparty to a threat. That there are some approaches to attribution which I don't think are constructive. So, for example, where attribution clauses drafted by some carriers refer to announcements being made by bodies like G7 or Interpol or Five Eye or something like that, that possibly doesn't reflect the nature of those the role of those institutions. It's rarely going to be appropriate for some of these institutions to adopt a position on the involvement of a state in perpetuating a cyber threat. And some of the clauses talk instead about a declaration of war or a government-sanctioned use of force. That's probably a better way to approach this topic within the context of this. Is so in this context, we're conflating both attribution and threshold, but that there needs to be a clear attribution to a state, and then it needs to lead to the government taking action. So it's a state using force against another state.
What about in situations? So we talked a bit about Viasat, and I want to make sure that we don't completely leave it. But that one was interesting because it was
a part of an armed operation. You know, that was, you know, traditional war with a little bit of cyber. Now, whether it was 2 weeks before, 2 weeks after, didn't meet a threshold, the war part is still there. So kind of, I don't know, is there more you can talk about on that?
Yeah, my understanding is that the attack on the Viasat satellite took place within about 1 hour before there was movement across the border by Russian troops and the convoy that we saw at that stage. So within that sort of time frame, I'm not sure that it's necessary for a clause to have any provision at all, because it's so clearly bundled up within the same activity by one state against another. I can see that if it's 1 hour before, it might be clear. If it's 1 week before, it might be clear. If it's 1 month before, it's possibly clear. If it's 1 year before, it's definitely not clear. So there would be a spectrum issue there. You know, where along that spectrum does it, is it part of war, and where is it just kind of just skirmishing between one nation and another, which does not meet the definition of war. And so introducing a clause which talks about the immediate preparation for war possibly doesn't answer that question, because, you know, what does immediate mean in that context? And I suspect that most experienced people who consider coverage issues would be able to reach a landing on what immediate means, but it is a subjective comment, and it's not entirely clear what that means.
I think the sort of, I don't know, we call it combined arms, I guess you could say, where you have, you know, you've got your army, your air force, your navy, and now your sort of cyber arm, and it's an integrated attack. It feels to me like one of the things that makes it hard to have a full-blown cyber war is everything's so interdependent. The systemic nature of cyber means that you're probably going to get hit too. You know, if you use these kind of, you know, unrestricted cyber attacks, you know, that have a big systemic impact, everybody's getting hit with that one. And you can't just kind of exclude yourself, you know, because you're a certain country. But these kind of combined operations, you know, seem to be where, from my perspective, it's probably a lot more likely to happen. And so I like really digging into those.
There's an interesting comment on that in the Merck Appellate Division judgment. They noted that NotPetya impacted some 64 states, one of which was Russia. And so if NotPetya was indeed to be attributed to Russia, then it absolutely did backfire on one of their major corporations.
So speaking of NotPetya, I guess, you know, my understanding is that even if these war exclusions, or maybe the most common war exclusions, have been in place, like NotPetya actually would have still been covered, you know, as it was under cyber policies. What are your thoughts on that?
The debate in the market is about constraining exposure to systemic risk. So although NotPetya proved to be a very substantial incident in that it caused billions of dollars of losses to corporations around the world, it probably didn't reach the systemic level where it endangered the ongoing viability of the insurance market, for example. So in a sense, although NotPetya was helpful in informing the background and some of the drivers to this, what we're really looking to exclude from insurers' exposure are incidents which are many times greater than NotPetya. And if an incident no greater than NotPetya were to occur today, then it may well be that would be largely covered under some of the exclusions that are in play. This is definitely a systemic risk debate. You know, we're talking about war and state hostile activity, state on state, which exceeds a certain threshold, and that threshold is likely to be greater than NotPetya. NotPetya didn't, for the most part, cause major detrimental damage to an essential service of a state. It caused massive disruption to specific corporations, but it didn't reach the thresholds that we're talking about.
I guess looking at that threshold question, I guess it's similar for Colonial Pipeline then as well, even though there was a level of disruption there. Is that the same situation?
Yes, I think that incident certainly had the potential to perhaps meet and exceed the threshold. But it was relatively quickly contained. And but had it continued, then I think the position on that's potentially less certain.
It does raise something that I wonder about, and I know you haven't had a lot of time to think about this, but maybe you know you've run into it before. So you know they took actions. You know the company took actions to shut systems down because of a fear of something spreading from one system to another. You know, does that impact any of these war exclusions? So if someone has actually taken actions to shut something down, and that's where the disruption's coming from, you know, does that change anything?
Certainly when drafting policies, I think about actual incidents, alleged incidents, threatened incidents, hoax of incidents. And I think it's appropriate that policy drafting considers all four of those elements within a cyber context. And it may well be that you've identified further considerations which are not adequately addressed in some of these clauses. What if it's not an actual incident, but the fear of an incident which is driving substantial losses? I think the clauses at the moment are not focused on that. It certainly wasn't necessarily something in my mind when drafting a number of clauses that are in use. But you're right to flag it, and it is perhaps something that requires further consideration.
Okay, interesting. Well, so kind of broadening it then, other challenges. Is there any sort of challenges you're seeing, you know, from where you sit today?
Collateral damage is an interesting topic. So this is where assets not within the target state are damaged. And not Petra, of course, resulted in far more collateral damage, I suspect, than it resulted in damage in Ukraine itself. So that's a very straightforward way to understand collateral damage. We're looking at not Petra type events. So Lloyd's has required syndicates to address collateral damage and to consider it, you know, one way or another. It needs to be expressly addressed, or if it's not included, you know, for that issue to have been considered. So not all the clauses include collateral damage write-backs. And some carriers like AIG include versions of their clause which have a collateral damage write-back, and others another clause which doesn't. It's appropriate for there to be a range of options available to insurers, because it will be a function of price as to which is most suitable for particular insurers. But that's certainly one of the issues that needs to be considered by carriers when writing this cover. As a general proposition, I welcome that the current iteration of the LMA clauses are shorter and clearer. Succinct and clear is always good in policy drafting. Certainly something that we seek to achieve. The attribution clause has been shortened. That's fine. As I said, the definition of war has been improved. A number of the more challenging concepts like bystanding cyber asset and retaliatory attacks and so on have been modified or omitted. And I think that's all helpful, because it's important that the broking community and insureds, risk managers at insureds, can readily understand these clauses. They're not necessarily going to spend days or weeks grappling with policy terms, trying to ensure that they meet their requirements. That's not a realistic expectation, particularly when you venture into the SME market. The level of familiarity with some of these issues may well be limited, and that's entirely reasonable. So it is important that the clauses are intelligible and you can read them once and understand what they mean without spending a great deal of time studying them. And so I think a lot of the clauses that I'm seeing at the moment, you know, the cyber AccuView clause, for example, it's admirably short. It uses clearly defined terms. There's different approaches. They've got the cyber war exclusion. They've got the widespread event exclusion. There's different options available to insured. So there's a range of options, and they've expressed it with as much clarity as possible. You know, all that's to be welcomed, I think.
I think the AccuView work is interesting, especially because there's so many insurers involved in AccuView. So it's something that, you know, if agreement can be made that it's you know, meets the standards, I think we'll see a lot of it.
Yeah, so Cyber AccuView members have a very substantial footprint in this market. So anything they do, you know, is going to be important, and it'll have ramifications for the market more generally. It's silent on attribution, but I don't think that's a critical issue, bearing in mind my comment that attribution clauses, for the most part, say little more than the parties will have regard to the evidence that is available to them. So omitting a provision on attribution in the Cyber AccuView clauses is not something that I view as material.
Well, I guess, you know, we've covered quite a bit. You know, there's a lot we could go with this, obviously. You know, it's a pretty deep topic. And I think people have been talking about it a lot. And I know it's just the kind of thing, I think the talking through it is actually really useful. And even though there's been so many conversations on it, I feel like I'm still learning a ton, and I really, really enjoy thinking about it and talking about it. Even though I'm not a wordings person, obviously, I'm mostly, you know, obviously I'm gravitated toward a different part of it, but it is interesting to think through these how it's all going to look. I guess to kind of close things off, you know, where do we go from here?
I think the market probably needs to move on from cyber war. It was absolutely right that the market looked at it. It needed to do so in the aftermath of NotPetya, in light of the Mondelez and Merck litigation, the fact that the traditional war exclusions did not address cyber. It's absolutely right that there should be a range of options available to insurers. But we need to move on. There's a whole range of systemic risks which insurers need to be thinking about, both within the cyber context and more generally across other lines of business. We did a systemic risk review for a substantial carrier in the London market, and we assessed their wordings by reference to about 50 different systemic risks. So war is a systemic risk. Cyber risk generally is a systemic risk, but there's a great deal of other systemic risks which the market needs to be grappling with and expending, you know, the time debating and thinking about the best way to approach them and the extent to which risk transfer to insurers is appropriate and affordable.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think as well, I think people will get a pretty good, now that these are in place, you know, there's a bit more activity going on, but it feels like it should kind of calm down a bit, and then people can move on and look at other, you know, systemic risks. So, well, great. Well, it was a pleasure having you on. Thanks a lot for coming, Julian. It's really great to have a real expert in war exclusion, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Anthony. It's been a pleasure.
If you want to learn more about our host Anthony or his company Aceris, visit aceris.com. aceris.com. Thanks to our friends at Savoo for producing this episode with us. See you next time.